Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Well, even the losers get lucky sometime. 3, 2, 1. Hey, this is Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, a new episode of whatever this is posted at WGNplus.com. And of course, don't forget to go to my landing page, which is also at WGNplus.com. Just go to the entertainment section and you'll see a prompt for my name, and you can pick up all the previously recorded podcasts of the last year or so. Today, episode 73. So in theory, there are 72 of them there. So that's about 72 hours. What are you doing on a weekend? You can't just binge from a Friday to a Sunday? I think you can. As I said, I think at this point, I'm fairly confident that I am binge-worthy. So this weekend, hey, it's a long, this will be posting on October 9th, which is a national holiday for a lot of people, Columbus Day. So you have even an extra day. So binge on an Elton Jim. On today's episode, we've got a few different topics going on. Boy, it's been a tough week over the last week or so with not only the Las Vegas shooting, which continues to dominate the news cycle, but, you know, we also lost a couple of major cultural icons, both in the pop culture world, our American culture, and in the music world. Hugh Hefner passed away, founder and publisher of Playboy magazine, and then a very shocking musical death in that Tom Petty, musical rock and roll legend, icon, you name it. Tom Petty, one of those guys that he sneaks up on you in terms of his musical catalog. You may say, oh, Tom Petty, oh, yes, I know who he is. And then you start to look at the list of his songs, or if you hear a lot of his music play in a row, you go, I forgot about Refugee. Oh, I forgot about Free Fall, and I forgot about Don't Come Around Here No More. I forgot about I Won't Back Down. I forgot about, and you keep saying that. And so what a shocking piece of news. And especially what was interesting about his death was the way it was announced. It was officially announced. Then it was officially retracted. And then 6 or 7 hours later, then it was officially confirmed again. So in the Pop Culture Club with Emily Arminetti, we will talk about Tom Petty, because Emily just saw him perform about a month and a half ago. He just finished, ironically, 3 or 4 days before he passed away, he just finished a 6-month tour, 53 shows, to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. It finished with a 3-run night at the stand at the Hollywood Bowl. And so at this point, as I record this, we just know that he died of cardiac arrest. I don't know what contributed to that, because I always find that interesting. At the end of the day, we all die of cardiac arrest, don't we? So I don't know if that's really a cause of death. When our heart stops, that's what causes us to die. But usually, you know, that's the end. But I'm wondering if there will be any further investigation as to what caused him having a cardiac arrest. We'll see as the weeks and months go by. But regardless, a huge loss in the musical world, and they just keep coming. And they have been for the last several years, especially last year. But, wow, this one was a shocker, no doubt, because there wasn't really any hint that Tom Petty was sick. And then we had the O.J. Simpson release from jail. And what is so funny about the way the news cycle works is that would have been major news. I mean, we all know what's gone on with O.J. Simpson in the last 20 years. It has been a Greek tragedy. Like it was a play, and it actually has been turned into a television show, which won an Emmy Award last year, The People versus O.J. Simpson, in dramatizing this whole thing. And what a story it's been. If you haven't seen, there's a documentary. I think it's called Made in America, The O.J. Simpson Story, which was on last year. And it really was a compelling story of here's a guy that rose to fame through sports, became one of the greatest college football players, had a very accomplished NFL career, never was on a winning team, but he certainly was an exciting player. And for a while, he had the record for the most yards gained in a season, over 2,000. I think it was 2003. And then he went on to become a very popular pop culture figure on television, did some broadcasting, appeared in several movies, commercials. And then, wow, about 20-some years ago, all that kind of charmed life certainly shifted. So he gets released from jail after 9 years for armed robbery, and that was going to be the big story. And then that, of course, just got completely overshadowed by the Las Vegas shooting, and rightfully so, with almost 60 people killed, more than 500 injured in a tragic and senseless just mass slaughtering and shooting. And still, as we record this, still looking for answers and clues as to why that happened. And then Tom Petty's death fell in right in between that while that was all going on. So he got sort of the short shrift on that in terms of getting a proper kind of, remembrance. And then Hugh Hefner died just before that. And again, a controversial icon. And so I thought we might as well, I mean, there's no doubt, the Las Vegas story will always be shifting and changing, and you always hear about that. But I thought it might be a good idea to talk about a few of these other stories that may have gotten bypassed, and as I said, rightfully so, but it doesn't diminish their inherent significance. It's just that when you've got a mass shooting, as the way it's being characterized now, the worst in U.S. history, that certainly takes precedence in terms of the national focus and certainly the mainstream media focus, and the 24-hour cable networks are certainly covering that from top to bottom. So I thought it might be good to just maybe give some time to some of these overlooked stories and some of these people that have passed or that new chapters in their lives, which certainly would have been, aside from that Vegas tragedy happening, would have been major topics that we probably would still be talking about. So I thought we would start with good old Hugh Hefner, because sitting here in Chicago, less than probably a mile and a half, 2 miles at the most, of where Playboy magazine started. The headquarters were right near on State Street, right across the street from Holy Name Cathedral, which is kind of interesting when you think about it. And then, of course, later, the Playboy Club, or the Playboy building, which is now the Palmolive building. It's a condo complex farther down on North Michigan Avenue. And for many years, that building was a very popular skyline picture because it had the Playboy masthead on the top of the building. And it was before there were such buildings like the John Hancock and the Sears Tower. When they took pictures of the Chicago skyline, they always got a shot of the Playboy building where the company headquarters then moved to, because it was such a prominent name in not only this country, but in the world. And so Hugh Hefner passes away at age 91, and it's a very complex legacy that he leaves, especially in today's society. We are certainly in a female empowerment culture right now. And so Hugh Hefner would seem to go exactly against that. And so it would be very easy to, if you don't really know the history of the magazine and who he was and when it was introduced and what its goals were, it would be very easy to say, oh, well, Hugh Hefner was a pervert, was a misogynist, and he denigrated and exploited women, and it would be easy just to discard him in that way. I don't think that's fair. I'm not saying that Hugh Hefner did not make money and did not live a lavish lifestyle based on the fact that he had a magazine that featured naked women. I'm not denying that. It's impossible to deny that. And you can certainly make the argument that there was some exploitation going on. But at the same time, as I've said many times when we talk about history, a few weeks ago I was talking about the Vietnam War with the PBS special. One thing that it's easy to do, but not really fair to do in many cases, is to take people out of their times and judge them by our standards. Because thankfully, as time has gone on through the decades and the centuries, even though we are still trying to be our best, and this Las Vegas shooting certainly shows that while we certainly try our best, there are moments when we revert right back to our violent species of what we are. And we are constantly battling that. But we are trying and we are moving forward. And so it's a good thing sometimes when you look back and you say, well, this person, look at that person, look at how terrible they were. Well, you know, were they really terrible in terms of their times? And that's what I think we have to do when we talk about Hugh Hefner. We've seen over the last several months the Confederacy and all the controversy about that, and, putting monuments to those who fought on the southern side to keep slavery as part of the American tradition. And the questions about the validity of those statues. And once again, these are wounds that continue never to heal. And but at the same time, we do have a conflicted history there. Because the person who actually wrote the Constitution that stated, and the Declaration of Independence, the man who wrote those words that said, all men are created equal and endowed with inalienable rights, which mean rights come from God. That's what unalienable rights means. The guy who wrote those words that we base our government on in this great experiment that America is called, the man who wrote those words was a slave owner. How could the same person who said all men are created equal own slaves? Well, once again, it's hard to take Thomas Jefferson out of his times. And as high-minded and as idealistic as he may have been, he was also a person of his times. And so when we look at Hugh Hefner, it's, as I said, it's a complex legacy. Because you say, oh, well, he put out a smut magazine. It's very easy to say, oh, he exploited women. It was a magazine filled with a bunch of naked women in centerfolds and just for a way for guys to look at naked ladies. And I'm not denying that. What's interesting is, as we sit here today in 2017, in a definite period of female empowerment, and we're seeing females in high, beginning to break the glass ceiling in terms of the corporate world, in terms of entertainment, in terms of government, We had the first woman, you know, whether she won or not, she was still the first woman, Hillary Clinton, to be nominated by one of our major parties for president. And you know, came very close to being the first woman president. So we are definitely in a time when the plight of women is being highlighted, and the girl power, whatever you want to call it, is certainly in vogue right now. And so you could look at Hugh Hefner and say, well, he's everything he's a male chauvinist and everything against that. But the irony is that I wonder if we would be going through this today, if not for Playboy magazine. And you say, Jim, what the heck are you talking about? Those seem to be completely in, against one another. Well, maybe they are, maybe they aren't. Once again, you can't take somebody out of their times. Playboy magazine was founded and came out in 1957. 1957 was in the middle of the Eisenhower era. Dwight D. Eisenhower was the president. And the American society was a very closed and very male-dominated and a very kind of black and white kind of world. There was very little gray area. This was right. This was wrong. And don't forget, America was founded by religious zealots. We forget that. On Thanksgiving, we say, oh, the pilgrims, and they have these nice big hats on, and they have the white socks, and they have the bonnets. But when you say the word pilgrim, you know, remember what pilgrim is. A pilgrim is basically, in the dictionary, somebody who, you hear the term a pilgrimage? Most people take a pilgrimage to a religious area. That's a pilgrimage. The pilgrims came here because they were being religious. They felt that they were being, what's the word I'm looking for here? But, they weren't able to freely practice their religion. They were looking for religious freedom. They were religious zealots who came, who wanted to leave England because they were not able to practice their religion they wanted to. They were willing to get on a boat and go to an unknown land in order to get away from them. So we were founded by religious zealots, which today, even in 2017, we look around and we say, oh my gosh, why are people so stuck on the Bible? And that's how we were founded. So we have a puritanical founding in our country, as liberally minded as we have continued to grow over the history of this country. We are also steeped in a very strict religious and Bible-centric philosophy. So once again, we're battling against ourselves. And in the 1950s, that puritanical view was dominant, and so that's why Playboy magazine was so revolutionary for its time, and that's why it took off, and that's why you can argue and say about Hugh Hefner, but he was a revolutionary. He put out a magazine that was trying to say, why is our society so stifling? And it wasn't just some horny guy, because it was actually, if you go back and look at some of Hugh Hefner's interviews at the very beginning of his career when he founded Playboy magazine, and there's a great and there's a very good documentary about him that I think is on Netflix that you can look and see if you really want to get a full breath of this. But what his whole philosophy was, and once again, he's not. Nobody's denying that they showed naked women. I understand that. But the naked women in the magazine were not just to cater to the men, but if you listen to what Hefner was saying, and a lot of times it gets superseded by the visual of naked women. But what he was trying to say is women are sexual beings too, and they're not being allowed to be that. We're in such a male-dominated world here that we're, you know, don't forget, in the 50s, very few women had jobs. If they did, they were secretarial jobs. They weren't jobs of power. They weren't jobs of prestige. There were a few women here and there, but in terms of a big thing. And at the same time, sex was a taboo word. You never talked about it. You never even admitted you had it. And women certainly were not promoted to even have sexuality, especially in public. It would be okay, you know, behind closed doors. But a woman in public needed to be covered and needed to be very refined, and she was almost asexual in terms of the image that she was projecting. And Hugh Hefner was saying, well, why are we stifling our sexual urges? Because that's what keeps our species going. And so the sexual liberation that he was espousing certainly played to the male species, but it also played to the female species. A liberation for them as well. And the whole Playboy philosophy was not just look at a magazine filled with naked women. The Playboy philosophy was very liberal-minded. Hugh Hefner here in Chicago, where, as I said, Playboy magazine started, for instance, was one of the early proponents of the civil rights movement. In 1959, the first Playboy Jazz Festival took place here in Chicago at the old Chicago Stadium. It featured Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, all African-American jazz greats who for many years were not even able to play sometimes in some American cities because of the institution of racism that was on our books. And if you hear stories, many times you will hear stories of some of the greatest entertainers, Nat King Cole, Sammy Davis Jr., as I said, Louis Armstrong, all these great African-American entertainers, they would go into a city and they would be playing at the main auditorium in a city, and yet they could not stay at the major hotel in that same city because of the laws at that time or the unwritten laws. But my point is, Hugh Hefner was not some misogynist, racist pervert. If anything, he was a very liberal-minded person. And if we look at our society today and how over the last 40 or 50 or 60 years, our country has certainly opened and from a very closed and very a puritanical society into a much more open and progressive society, what Hugh Hefner helped do back in the late 50s and then throughout the 60s and 70s was tear down many of those puritanical walls. Yes, sex was involved. I'm not denying that. But there were other social issues. The comedian who just passed away about a month or so ago, it was an African-American comedian named Dick Gregory. And Dick Gregory gave full credit to Hugh Hefner for helping his career, without a doubt. There was a show that was filmed out of Chicago called Playboy After Dark. And once again, it was an integrated show. We look today and we say, what's the big deal? If you look back at 50s television, there were very few African Americans on television. It was all white. That was the picture of America. Hugh Hefner's show, Playboy After Dark, featured African American actors, comedians, musicians, very integrated. So when you look at Hugh Hefner and you say,
Well, all he did was, you know, put a bunch of naked women in a magazine. No. What Hugh Hefner was trying to do was to break down some of these puritanical, religious-based, or whatever, or oppressive kind of moralities, and saying, wait a minute, folks, shouldn't we have some fun in our lives? And why are we repressing some of our natural feelings for pleasure? Whether it is sex, whether it is alcohol, whether it is sports. Playboy magazine, you know, one of the jokes was, I only read it for the articles. Well, there's a reason why that kind of joke became popular. That joke became popular because Hugh Hefner did work in the magazine and journalism world. And in between those pictures, yes, they were there. But in between those pictures, there were stories by some of the greatest writers of the day. Writers like Norman Mailer and Truman Capote. There were there was the annual Playboy music poll. There was the annual Playboy, as I said, the jazz festival started here in 1959, and then it was resumed in the 70s. It's one of the longest jazz music festivals in our history, and still very prominent, the Playboy Jazz Festival. So, Playboy magazine, I have to say, and I'm not even ashamed to admit it. Hey, like every young kid in the United States, especially if you grew up in the 70s and 80s, Playboy was kind of your first initiation. And so, yeah, I read Playboy magazine. In fact, I still have some of my old copies. I have like the 25th anniversary issue, and I have the 30th anniversary. I had them stored away. I haven't looked at them in years. In fact, I just found this one because I knew I had it. January 1984, the 30th anniversary. And as I'm paging through this, I mean, there's no doubt that there's some naked women in here, but there's also stories written by Ray Bradbury, one of the great science fiction writers of all time, by John Updike, by Truman Capote. There is some art by Andy Warhol. There was a lot of great stories in this magazine. The Playboy interview was always featured a prominent person, whether it was in sports and culture and politics. It was a very in-depth interview. And because it was in the pages of Playboy, these interviews were a little more, they were longer, and they were in depth. And these people that may have not been so forthcoming, they opened up a little and got off the script because they figured, well, it's Playboy. And so some of the great interviews would be in, and so, yes, I understand. Yeah, there's a centerfold in there. When I would read it, even as a young kid, I'd always want to read who's the interview this week or this month. And it always had its own, the Playboy interview. It was called the Playboy interview, like in this issue from January 84, Dan Rather. A candid conversation with the CBS anchor and America's top broadcaster. He had just taken over from Walter Cronkite. And the format was always the same. There were three pictures, kind of candid pictures of them in the process of talking, with a little pull quote underneath from the interview. And then it was just a Q&A of here's a question, here's the answer. And there were jokes. And once again, I'm not, you know, but yes, and a lot of the jokes had sexual kind of connotation to them. And there was little Annie Fanny. I mean, once again, we all know what Playboy was. At that time, during the 70s, at one time, Playboy was selling 7 million copies a month. So there certainly was something of a public need or a want for this kind of magazine. In 2017, we have seen many magazines. And a few weeks ago, I talked about the demise of Rolling Stone. In fact, at that time, I even brought up Playboy as another magazine that may just be past its time. Yes, we are in an era now where the equality of the sexes, and so maybe this does feel very dated and exploitative. And so maybe it's just time for Playboy to go away, but you can't deny its impact of its day because it did help to break down some of these very short-sighted and very narrow-minded views of how of what was the right way to live. And you can make an argument that some of the walls and the barriers that Playboy magazine helped break down have brought us to the progressive area that we are today. You know, don't forget, nobody forced any of these women to pose in this magazine. And in many ways, Playboy helped create some careers. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but you cannot deny the impact that Playboy magazine had in its day and the important role it played in opening up our culture. And some may argue that that was a bad thing. So once again, that depends on where you fall on the spectrum. But if you are somebody who is progressive in their thinking, I do believe, as complex and as perhaps as confused as it may sound, you do owe Hugh Hefner some debt, because he brought Playboy into the mainstream. He brought a progressive, liberal-minded, liberating kind of philosophy into the mainstream. Whether it wasn't just about naked women, it was about injustices in our culture and things that didn't make any sense. As I said, at the end, at the core of this was, why are we suppressing our natural urges? And our natural urges are that we should live together. We should do what we want to do. We should look for pleasure in not just sexual pleasure, but professional pleasure and personal pleasure. And so much of that in the 50s, and even before that, it was a very oppressive kind of culture of this is right and this is wrong. And Hugh Hefner helped break those things down. Did he do that with some pictures of naked women? Yes, he did. But that was a part of a bigger kind of thing he was trying to do. So I would say he leaves a complex legacy because of the era that we're in. But I would urge you to do some research on not just Hugh Hefner, but on the times of which Hugh Hefner emerged. And you may understand the important role that he did play in some ways. And then you could make up your own decision. You can make up your own mind. But I don't think it's fair just to quickly dismiss him as someone that peddled porn. Playboy was far from porn when you think about what kind of pornography is out there. So Hugh Hefner passes away at age 91, and we will see what will happen to the Playboy empire. It will be very interesting to see if that magazine continues to stick around. And as I said, it may just have been an idea that was needed for its time, and now as we have progressed, it has worn out its welcome. We will see what happens. But I think it still is important not to just dismiss Hugh Hefner, because he did play a role in breaking down a lot of social barriers on a lot of different topics. Very quickly, I wanted to talk about O.J., because O.J. would have been a huge story that we would be talking about. In fact, O.J.'s release came the same day, a few hours before the tragedy in Las Vegas. And the reason why there was so much media in Las Vegas when the shooting took place is because they were all there for the O.J. release. No one knew exactly when he knew he was going to get out on October 1st on Sunday, but they didn't know when. It was kept secret. And so the media was congregating in Vegas, and then they slipped O.J. out of jail sort of in the cloak of darkness at, like, I think it was 12:08 Vegas time, under a cloak of secrecy so there wouldn't be a media circus. And then several hours later in Las Vegas, there was a real media circus and a terrible tragedy. And so the Hugh Hefner death and certainly the OJ release got overshadowed. As I said at the beginning, OJ is a very interesting story because he led, he came up in a very difficult upbringing, and then through his athletic prowess was able to go to USC, a prestigious California college, and he became one of the best college football players of all time, won the Heisman Trophy. Went on to become one of the best football players of his era. As I said, for a time, held the single-season rushing record. And then went on to a very successful career in business and in pop culture in terms of broadcasting and movies and television and commercials. And in many ways, we were talking about the breaking down of society where O.J., And once again, there's a great documentary about him. I think it was called Made in America that came out last year, around the same time that the TV show came out about the People versus O.J. Simpson. This documentary traces his entire life, and O.J. really was an anomaly, because even in the '60s and '70s, when racial tensions were very at a peak. LJ was somehow able to cross the color line. His prowess in sports allowed him to become a mainstream celebrity. Not just a sports celebrity, but a mainstream celebrity. And if for that time, an African-American to be a spokesperson on a commercial. Once again, we look at this thing and go, what's the big deal? What are you talking about? Well, once again, you can't take somebody out of their times. And in the mid-60s and early 70s, there were very few African-Americans who were doing commercials. And if they did, they were doing commercials aimed at African-Americans. But OJ became this colorless personality. He appealed on both sides of the racial spectrum. And so Hertz, the rent-a-car company, which is dealing with is looking at the entire country as one of its customers, used OJ as their spokesperson. And that was a huge, huge deal. As I said, in 2017, we look back at that and we say, what are you talking about? Well, you have to remember the times. So OJ had this charmed life from his high school and college days through his adulthood, and then, wow, did things turn for him. And, we all know the story about the divisive, trial and the murder of Ron Goldman and O.J.'s wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and the Dream Team and Johnny Cochran and F. Lee Bailey and DNA, and if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. And it really became a pop culture, circus more than a trial. And when I look back now, 20 some years now that it's been since the OJ verdict came down, it really was a turning point in I don't know if we would call it the reopening, or maybe a more transparency of, once again, the race divide in this country. It may have started it. There was Rodney King around the same time, and there was OJ, where people were looking at those cases purely on racial lines. And, of course, now, over the last several years, we've had, these occurrences with the police, and African Americans. We had the rise of the Black Lives Matters movement. And so the OJ trial actually could have been a precursor to where we are today in showing the true divide that we were kind of denying existed. And the irony is that in this time when you've got this racial divide, we also had our first African-American president. So the last 25 years have been very interesting in terms of race relations. And O.J.'s trial certainly did, if not open a wound, picked a scab and really sort of illuminated maybe things weren't as peaceful as we thought in terms of race relations. But, you know, then O.J. gets, you know, he wins the lottery by getting acquitted. Because, I mean, you know, I don't know, you know, his lawyer team did a great job in finding him not guilty. But there's a big difference between being found not guilty and being innocent. He was found not guilty. And so, incredibly, when so much evidence against him was there, and he is acquitted, then soon afterwards, who knows what motivated him to get involved in some weird, ridiculous armed robbery to get back some of his stuff that was stolen. And it winds him back in jail. And he's been in jail for 9 years. And many people felt like it was almost kind of a weird little karmic wheel that he wound up going to jail, even though he didn't go to jail for what he was may have been initially responsible for and could have had a life sentence, certainly, if he had been convicted of murder. But here's now O.J. gets paroled at age 70. And I just hope, and I, you know, once again, hey, I used to enjoy O.J. Simpson in the airplane movies and things like that and stuff like that. But, or no, he was in the Naked Gun movies, right? Yeah. But O.J., at this point, we are in a very divisive time right now. And O.J.'s story and what he symbolizes, that scab does not need to be opened again. We've got enough open wounds right now. So my hope is, really, you know, O.J., you got lucky a couple of times. You got lucky getting acquitted the first time. You got lucky getting paroled now. You're 70 years old. Do yourself, do your family, and do this country a favor and just go away. I don't think we need to see an O.J. Simpson reality show. I don't want to see O.J. on the loose, the juice on the loose. We don't need to see the juice on the loose. We don't need to see an interview with O.J., with Oprah, or with Megyn Kelly, or with somebody like that, or Barbara Walters. We don't need to see that. I heard a story that he's peddling a $3 to $5 million interview. He will talk to somebody for $3 to $5 million. Please, media, do not look at the short term like, oh, we might be able to get some good ratings. Look at the long term of bringing O.J. back and all that he symbolizes now, for better or worse. Please, let us as a society and as a culture, we don't need O.J. to come back and remind us about all that and hear what he has to say. Because unless he's going to admit that he killed his wife and Ron Goldman, I don't know what else is he going to talk about. That's the only thing we need to hear from O.J., and he's never going to say it. So don't give him the $5 million. And now the Goldman family, they have to come back and deal with this, because if you remember, they won a civil suit against him. He was found guilty of killing Ron Goldman in a civil suit, even though he was acquitted in the criminal suit. So all his money that he may make, they have access to it. So they're going to have to come back now and relive the fact that Ron Goldman, the son, and Ron Goldman, the brother, is dead. And the Simpson and Nicole family is going to have to go over that. OJ's kids are here. Please, OJ, do yourself a favor. Do your family a favor. You got out of jail on a very questionable, even a parole kind of hearing, but you're lucky you got out again. This is twice you've got lightning in a bottle. You're 70 years old. Spend some time with your family, with your kids, and just stay out of the spotlight. And just be grateful of what you have and how it happened to you. Because you have won a lottery. As much as all you've gone through, the fact is you're 70 years old and you're free right now. by all intents and purposes, he should have had probably a double life sentence and he never would have a chance for parole. And yet here he is at 70 out of jail. Appreciate and be grateful for your good fortune, whatever that may be. Spend some time with your family. Go golfing, but I don't want to see an O.J. Simpson Instagram or a bunch of selfies or, as I said, a reality show. We don't need to see that. I think it would be more divisive, especially in today's society where we've already got some problems we need to attend to in terms of race relations. And sadly, O.J. will bring all that up again in another kind of way. So, Juice, you've had your moment. Take your bow and please just spend time with your kids and be grateful you're a free man after a 20 years of a pretty wild ride. The fact that you're free at age 70 is a gift. Take advantage of the gift. But we don't need to see you. We don't need to hear you anymore. We've seen enough and we've heard enough. Unless you're going to admit that you did it. Aside from that, Casera, could you hit that little music there, please? And we come back here to Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. And now we go to the Pop Culture Club with Emily Arminetti. How you doing, Emily?
Hey, Jim. You know, I have to be honest. I usually say I'm doing well, but I am so bummed.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
You are actually one of the first people that I thought of when I heard about the death of Tom Petty. Because what's so interesting, it was very ironic, you saw him, when did you see him?
In May. That was the last time that I saw him live in May, in Austin.
In Austin. And the funny thing is, a year ago, when I first contacted you to be a part of the podcast, I said, well, I don't know, what topics do you want to talk about? You know, got any topics? Mm-hmm. And the first topic that you mentioned to me, which really kind of shocked me, was you said, well, you know, I just saw this great documentary on Tom Petty.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't we talk about Tom Petty? And I was like, well, I mean, I certainly am a huge fan of Tom Petty's, but at the same time, you know, that documentary was from like 2007 or 2008. And, I didn't really see a news peg to it, and I was like, well, maybe somewhere down the line we could talk about Tom Petty when it's a little more of a news peg. And so when he passed away, I was just like, oh, my gosh. I mean, I sort of had Tom Petty on my mind, and I have Sirius Radio, and on my presets, Tom Petty had his own radio station.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so I have
number five on my preset.
Yeah, I have the Tom Petty, radio station on my preset. And so, yeah, I mean, I was really bummed out by this, but I did think of you almost instantaneously because I remember you saying how good the show was, and we talked about it briefly here, back in May and June after you'd seen him, and we talked a little bit about him, but and talk about a weird circumstance. I mean, not only was the news shocking, but it comes right in the middle of the Las Vegas shooting, so it sort of got overshadowed.
Yeah.
And then they denied he was dead. It wasn't until about eight hours later.
There was definitely some confusion, which I think comes down to, I think I said this to you, I think... when that news broke about Tom Petty, I think whoever released this news to the media was probably unauthorized to do so. So there was a little bit of a backpedal there. Although I don't know, because if you believe then, the stories that came out after, his family and his manager confirmed that he had actually passed away, the timing doesn't line up. It sounds like actually maybe he was still alive when news outlets were reporting that he was gone. And I tell you what, I mean, the initial news was such a kick in the gut that, man, I was really hoping and praying that, oh, wait, maybe it, you know, it's not true, and maybe he will pull through this, and maybe they were just being really hasty and the media just, you know, jumped the gun. So
yeah, I was listening. Yeah. I was in my car, and I was listening to the radio, and in the midst of conversation, they said, oh, we just got some breaking news. Tom Petty is dead. And I was like, what? Mm-hmm. And so then I went home and I got on the computer and here's the thing. And then I just, you know, hit Tom Petty and I saw some stories. And then I went to Rolling. Here's the kicker from my standpoint. So then I went on RollingStone.com and I see a quote from Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, you know, and speaking of Tom Petty in the past tense. So, you know, because they.
Yeah,
you know,
and of course, Bob Dylan was a long time collaborator.
Well, yeah, but my point is, I would think that Bob Dylan would know. I would think that somebody would tell Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And so.
I mean, well, you know, it's one of those things where I think this obviously was something that was unexpected, you know, and anyone who's had a family member or anything that where you have some an unexpected health event and everyone's sort of rallying and at the hospital and trying to figure out what's going on, you know, I think it does probably take a while because you're in this little cocoon of trying to just be a family and rally. So, you know, the sad thing for me thinking about that is that some reporter called up Bob Dylan and said,
right.
Oh,
well,
you know,
how do you feel?
Tom Petty, your good friend and longtime collaborator, has passed away. What is your reaction? Because you hate to think of Bob Dylan finding out that way too. You know, if that's actually what
yeah, I don't like. See, that was my point. I mean, Bob Dylan doesn't talk about anything. So I wonder if Bob Dylan, because it was a very quick quote. So my question is, did Bob Dylan find out from a reporter from Rolling Stone,
right.
And he assumes that Rolling Stone has the credibility, so he just buys that, or did Bob Dylan already have previous knowledge from, you know, a friend or from the family that he, in fact, did pass away, or that he was off life support, or he was, you know, he was, for all intents and purposes, he was gone, and so he felt comfortable in giving that quote because he was told that, you know, he was gone. So, but what I was saying was interesting because then I posted a picture up of on my Facebook page. And I said, you know, well, this is going to be a tough one to process, you know, because I was in shock, just like you said you were. And then I get a post on there that from somebody that says, hey, he's not officially dead. And I'm like, what is this guy talking about? So then I go back online, then I'm starting to read all these retractions. And I'm like, so finally, what, 6 or 7 hours later, like 10:30 Chicago time, they finally, you know, announced that he had passed away. So who knows what really happened. And at the end of the day, I mean, from all the accounts I read, he was in cardiac arrest. There was no brain activity. Whether he really died 6 hours before or not, it sounds like he was in some serious trouble. And even if he had passed, or even if he had, you know, physically recovered in terms of brain activity or something, it sounds like major damage had already been done. And so I don't think that he would have been had any kind of quality of life. But man, I'll tell you. So now you tell me, what was that concert like?
Oh, so yeah, I mean, so that I've seen him a couple of times, and I would say the same thing about both shows. So I saw him live at Madison Square Garden in 2014, back when I was living in Brooklyn, and then this show just recently in May was at the Frank Irwin Center in Austin. These are you know you've been to Madison Square Garden. These are big venues.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, I think seeing him live, he seems like such a dichotomy in a way to me because, like, if you've ever seen him interviewed, you know, he comes across as this real kind of mellow guy and...
Oh, yeah, like hippie, you know, hippie dippy, kind of trippy,
Yeah, real easygoing and kind of laid back and, you know, maybe even a little humble, I would say. And, you know, and he's got kind of a folksy voice, you know, he's not... Technique-wise, not necessarily doesn't have the most perfect voice even on his records, but when I saw him live, the first time was at Madison Square Garden, I was blown away by how good he sounded. I mean, he sounded great. He sounded exactly like he sounds on his albums, and the thing is, he sounded exactly like he sounds on his albums 30 years ago.
Right.
You know, because that's the other thing. It's like, he doesn't have the kind of voice that I would necessarily think would be sort of like really high quality, clear as a bell, it live at a huge venue, you know. But also, you know, a lot of these, like even, you know, some of the most talented artists over time as they age, you know, the quality of their voice starts to suffer. I mean, honestly, he sounded great. It was like, you know, you're listening to him 30 years ago, voice crystal clear. But the other thing that's really interesting about seeing him live is, you know, again, I mean, he sort of seems to have this kind of mellow, laid-back personality, but he really had an energy on stage that was electric. And I don't think I expected that to be the case going into it. And so, you know, and I also thought more than anything else, I thought he does a really good job of connecting with his audience, you know. I mean, when he's singing Free Fallen, which he's probably sung, I mean, how many times do you think he's probably sung that, right, you know, live in his in his career? But, you know, he'll sort of say, like, so, hey, what do you guys think about having just, like, a little sing-along? You know, and right. Meanwhile, there are, like, tens of thousands of people out there, and he's just leading them in this, you know, because that song is really...
Oh, that's like an anthem. Yeah,
I mean, everybody.
Yeah, I mean,
exactly. That's... And, you know, I think it's a really special experience. I'm so grateful that I got to see him live. And it's really, it's ironic in a way because, you know, you were mentioning that you heard the news of his death on Sirius. 2 weeks ago, I was driving, I wasn't listening to the Tom Petty station, but on another station, I think it was Spectrum, they had just played one of his songs, and then the DJ was just kind of doing a little bit about him and said, like, oh, you know, and they're just wrapping up their 40th anniversary tour, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and, you know, they're saying that this is it. This is, you know, this is like a goodbye tour. And when the DJ said that, I distinctly remember thinking, wait, what? Like, what? I really hope I get more chances to see him live. But I think he has said that, you know, as far as, you know, these big national tours or global tours, like, right, he wasn't really going to be doing that anymore. And to me, that was such a shame that it actually kind of stopped me in my tracks thinking, oh, no, I hate to hear that. And now here we are 2 weeks later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing about Tom Petty is, like most great artists of any kind, whether it's music, whether it's, you know, painting, whether it's writers, whatever kind of artistic you know, endeavor, most of the greats, and they completely admit this, most of the greats are influenced and even, you know, steal to some extent from their influences or from the past. They do that willingly. But what's important is it's not just plagiarism. What you do is you are influenced, and then you take those influences and you infuse your own style into making it something different and special, even if the influences are there. And there's no doubt when you listen to Tom Petty's music, you hear Bob Dylan, like you're saying, with his voice.
Mm-hmm.
He sings sort of like Bob Dylan at times. There's no question that he was influenced by the Beatles. And there's clearly no doubt that he was influenced by the Birds with that jangling guitar. And so you hear that in his music, and yet it's not a ripoff. He takes those foundations, because everybody that's great does the same thing. The Beatles did that. The early Beatles took the influences of Chuck Berry and Little Richard and the early 50s and Elvis and made it their own. So everybody that does that, that's the key to an artist.
Yeah.
Picasso did the same thing.
I think for Tom Petty, a true testament to how he was able to do that but still very much find his own sound is the fact that some of his biggest influences went on to be some of his closest collaborators, you know. I mean, Roger McGuinn of the Byrds, Bob Dylan, as you mentioned, and even George Harrison from the Beatles.
Oh, yeah, no, so, I mean, so, I yeah, mean, I think he got to be actual friends. Yeah, he got to actually be friends with these people as well as make music with them. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, as I said at the beginning of the thing, Tom Petty's one of these kind of artists that kind of catches up, like it's you kind of catches up on you in that you start to listen to, or even if you don't listen to all the music, you start to read the titles and you go, oh, I forgot about that. Oh, I forgot about that. Oh, I forgot about I Won't Back Down. Oh, I forgot about American Girl. I forgot about Listen to Her Heart. I forgot about I Need to Know. I forgot about Breakdown. I forgot about Free Fall. And I forgot about Into the Great Wide Open. I mean, you could just continue to go. I mean, he's had such, and to his credit, you know, he had his initial burst with I Still Think is probably his best album and maybe one of the best rock albums ever is Damn the Torpedoes from 1979. That was the one that really put him on the map. But so you would say, okay, well, you know, that was kind of his peak, but then he had big hits in the 80s, and then he and then in the late 80s and in the 90s with his solo stuff where he had I Won't Back Down, as I said, as you mentioned, Free Falling, all that stuff was from later albums. And so he was not just sort of a one-hit wonder who then kind of just rested on his laurels. He had little, you know, he continued as the decades to go on to get, and then, I mean, one of my favorite albums of all times is the first Traveling Wilburys album. And you know his contributions on all those songs, as well as the ones that he wrote, are some of his best songs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think you totally hit the nail on the head. I mean, I think even as a big fan of his, I think it's very easy to take him for granted.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
Because he does sneak up on you. You know, he is kind of this very unassuming persona, pretty humble. And I think it's really easy to underestimate or take for granted the depth of his artistry. And, you know, when you start looking at his lyrics, you know, if you really look at them, I mean, they are poetic, but in a very modern, relatable way. And I saw this a really good article on Vulture this week called Why the Loss of Tom Petty Feels So Deeply Personal. And it was by a woman named Jen Chaney. And basically what she said is there are two reasons why this is, I'm you know, paraphrasing here, but she's saying there are two reasons why this is so devastating for so many people. Number one, because his career was so long, it just felt like he would always be around and that music was always there. But his songs were written with such specificity that they felt extraordinarily personal. And it's so true. I thought that is such a great way of summarizing his lyrics, because when you really sit and look at them, and we just take it for granted because we know them, we sing them, we don't even think about it when we're singing them. But, you know, I think it was almost like a sneak attack in a way. You could forget that how truly talented he was. And I also think his integrity, and this is one of the things I really loved about that documentary, which, you know, is honestly worth, it's 4 hours long. It's worth every second.
It's called Running Down a Dream.
Down a Dream. Peter Bogdanovich directed it. And it's on Netflix right now, and it has been for a while. But there are a few, like, I mean, the whole thing is great. But when you watch it, you really see some great examples of his artistic integrity. You know, like, they talk about some of the things that he did to kind of stand up to, like, MCA over publishing rights, and also to go to battle with the record label when they tried to jack up the price of his albums by $1.
Right.
You know, and he didn't like that was going to happen to fans, that they were going to have to pay even more money for the music. And he, you know, and he really fought hard for that and stood up to the industry in a way that not really anybody else was doing at the time. And, you know, it's just there, you watch stuff like that and you kind of realize, like, wow, not only was this guy a great artist, but, you know, he also had just a lot of artistic integrity.
And well, what's funny, what you say is, you know, he comes off as kind of this kind of hippie, trippy, kind of laid back guy, but he also was very outspoken, and he had a lot of attitude and he had a lot of anger. In fact, when he was recording his 1985 album, Southern Accents, which is actually one of my favorites, he was working with Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics, and he was, I don't know if he was not happy what was happening in the recording studio, but he was so angry and passionate about the music that he broke his hand hitting a wall.
Yeah.
He broke his guitar playing hand because he was just not happy with it. So he certainly had his demons. He had a weird kind of relationship with his father. So as much as he looked kind of very laid back and kind of hippy dippy, he also was, to your point, he was very, he had a lot of integrity. He had an attitude. He had an anger. You know, he went through some ups and downs with the Heartbreakers and did some solo things, and there were some hurt feelings there. But at the same time, I think they all came together. And What was very interesting, the first time I ever saw him live was in 1981, and it was interesting because it was right around this time that you're talking about. The Hard Promises album came out, and that was the one that, mm-hmm. that MCA, that had The Waiting on it and some hits, and that was the one that that they wanted to raise the retail price from $8.98 to $9.98.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was protesting that to the point where he was going to name the album $8.98.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But so it was so funny too, was here in Chicago, there was a big, you know, there used to be a huge kind of radio wars between the rock stations. And there were two major rock stations at that time. There was WMET and WLUP, and the Loop is still around. MET is gone. And so what the Loop did was, Petty was, you know, coming out with this new album in 81, and it was right off the popularity of Damn the Torpedoes from 79, his next release. And so he was going to do a show at the Allstate Arena, but it was the Rosemont Horizon at the time. So the Loop bought all the tickets. They bought the entire arena out, and then they were giving away free tickets. So it was a free concert.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it was, so in these radio war days, the program director, who actually went to my college, and I know him now, which is kind of interesting, but at the time, I didn't know. I was 15, 16 years old. But MET was so mad that the Loop thought of doing this, because Tom Petty was huge at that time. He was, you know,
yeah,
major star. And they felt like they got, you know, aced out in these radio wars. So they decided, if Tom Petty, if you're going to allow the Loop to buy all those tickets to your concert and them give it away, because now, I mean, that's a huge thing. I mean, in fact, I went to that concert. I got a pair of the free tickets. Through the lottery. The MET would not play the new Tom Petty album.
Oh wow!
Yeah, for
that's
like,
okay, though, because Tom Petty didn't need that.
No, but my point is that was kind of the thing. Yeah. So I remember going to see that concert, and then I was and now in retrospect, I probably saw him about four or five times over my lifetime. But I was so happy to see he and the Heartbreakers played a tour with Bob Dylan in the mid '80s, and the Heartbreakers played a set at the beginning, and then they were Bob Dylan's backing band for Bob Dylan's set.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really cool because you got to see this double whammy, and you did see the influence of Bob Dylan on Tom Petty. And to be honest with you, I think that tour was the last time that Bob Dylan played songs that you could actually recognize. Because now he changes, you know, he changes all the arrangements, and you don't even know half the time what song he's playing. But back then, with the Heartbreakers, they played, you know, the original arrangements, and they really, you know, gave Bob Dylan kind of a kick in the butt, because it sort of helped Bob Dylan actually become known now to a new generation. Because the irony was that Tom Petty, in a way, was helping to introduce Bob Dylan to people my age, you know, at that time. So it was a very cool concert, and one of the best ones. I mean, you know, it was just what a night. That was at Poplar Creek. So, as you said, I was lucky enough to see him. And where Tom Petty, I think, like you were saying, you saw him over the last couple of years, and, you know, they just had this documentary. The one thing that sadly haunted Tom Petty, as big as his albums are and as deep as his catalog is, there was always this kind of semi-rivalry with Bruce Springsteen as being, who's the greatest American rocker? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so but my point is, I think in the last 10 or 15 years, Tom Petty's respect by the fans and by his peers and even by the critics and everything else, I think over the last 10 or 15 years, because of, like you were saying, the depth as well as the variety between his work with the Heartbreakers, his solo stuff, his work with the Wilburys, and with other bands, and Jeff Lynne and Bob Dylan and you know, and George Harrison, and the Byrds and stuff like that, I think that there was a growing, a new depth of respect for him that maybe had he had been overshadowed during, because he's around the same age as Bruce Springsteen, so they were sort of always competing, and now that they're older, you know, they don't, that competition is gone, and now you could start to really appreciate the music and the artistry and the artists themselves, and to your point that they're still out there, and he was sounding as good and playing as good as ever. So actually, even though he had been maybe overlooked for many years, even during his heyday and during his prime, thankfully, I think, you know, sadly, as we say goodbye to him, I think, you know, he went before he died. I think he was getting that kind of recognition. And I think he felt that he was getting that recognition.
Yeah, I think he definitely had reached that point where he was being viewed as one of the elder statesmen.
Right. Exactly.
Of rock and roll.
Right.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's good in respect that he, but I think that only time will you know, elevate, because I mean, hopefully as more people go in and discover the depth of his catalog, as I said, album for album, there's always on any album, you know, even some albums that didn't do as well as others, there are still some great songs. I would definitely, I mean, to me, any rock and roll record collection worth its salt has to have Damn the Torpedoes in it, or it's not really.
Mm-hmm.
And Full Moon Fever is another one. Wildflowers is another one. There was just a lot of albums that, you know, as I said, the Wilburys is one of the best rock albums ever, with that super group of Harrison and Dylan and Jeff Lynne and Roy Orbison. Sad part is there's only two Wilburys left.
I know.
I mean, who would have thought that? And you never would have thought that Bob Dylan would have outlived, you know,
one of them.
You know, Roy Orbison, or you know, or certainly George Harrison and Tom Petty. So you know, it is kind of sad. And in fact, the other thing is too, on one of Johnny Cash's final albums, the Heartbreakers played on that, and. You know, you shouldn't forget, you know, the great song he does with Stevie Nicks, Stop Dragging My Heart Around.
Oh, gosh. You know, Stevie Nicks, well, she says in the Running Down a Dream documentary, you know, she's interviewed for that. And, you know, there's a whole, you know, bit about their collaboration together. And, you know, she basically said, I mean, I just love this guy so much. I wanted to be in the Heartbreakers.
Right.
I asked if I could join them. They sort of thought about it and they went like, well, we really
right.
love you, but there's no girls in the Heartbreakers.
Right.
No girls in the Heartbreakers. But she really, you could tell, and you can tell, you know, watching her, you know, being interviewed and talk about Tom Petty in particular, that she just really adored him. But, you know, I also think that there are some really interesting insights there about their collaboration, how it unfolded, how certain song, he, you know, wrote a song for her and then decided, ooh, this is really good. I actually think I want to keep this one for myself.
Right.
And then he went on to write another song for her. And you know, and then, you know, she was also sort of involved in Don't Come Around Here No More. But then it was decided that he was going to go his own way with that. And, you know, really, you know, also a very, for sure, a very interesting and a great collaboration between the two of them. And they certainly had a...
No, I would say, too, I mean, what's good about it is that he had a really very dry and, you know, kind of ironic sense of humor, which not only comes through in his lyrics, but one of the great MTV videos of all times is for Don't Come Around Here No More.
Yeah.
Where the whole takeoff on the on Alice in Wonderland, that was an MTV staple, and it still holds up and it's still cool. And that's when he started to wear those big kind of, you know, Mad Hat or top hats and the little, you know, hippie glasses, and which was a look that he continued to, you know, to have throughout the years. So, and I would say there's one song, a lot of people don't know. Once again, there's an album that came that is on. It's called Southern Accents. If you haven't heard that album, check out that album. And I'll tell you, there's a beautiful love song on there that's called The Best of Everything. And I remember back in '86 listening to that and being touched by it, and it still is. So, you can go out and find a lot of Tom Petty music out on the internet now, and there's greatest hits albums and live albums and all that. But check out this song called "Best of Everything," because it's one of those little hidden gems. And there are so many of those by Tom Petty. if this one doesn't tug at your heart, I don't know what does. And so we will miss him. I think he had a lot of attitude, he had a lot of respect, and he had a lot of talent, and he really was a great fan of rock and roll as well as a great practitioner of it. And this one's going to be hard to process. I'm really bummed out about this one.
Yeah.
So.
It is. It's going to be tough. But, we'll be probably, I think, thinking about this and I think it's going to take a little while to get over it. I feel like this is a little bit how I felt when Prince unexpectedly passed away. So, of course, you know, it's not the only thing happening in the world right now.
I think it's worth talking about because, like I said, I mean, that certainly, you know, the Vegas thing certainly is important and it certainly does take precedence. But at the same time, you know, if that hadn't happened, we'd be hearing a lot more about Tom Petty. And so hopefully when this kind of dies down, he will be remembered. So I thought it would be a good idea to talk about it amidst all the other information.
Sure. Yeah, it's too bad it took this for me to finally convince you that we need to talk about Tom Petty.
I know. Well, like I said, I was always a huge fan. I wonder what's going to happen to his Sirius station now, because he used to actually host a show. He would be on it. It wasn't just his music. He used to be on it. You know, Tom Petty's Buried Treasures. You know, he used to play all these songs, and he used to have that little voice, and here's a song by, you know. And he had a very wide range of musical tastes, and a lot of times I found that my taste and his tastes were very similar. So, well, once again, Emily, you have shown that you had insight that I didn't. But sadly, we do get a chance to talk about Tom Petty. Unfortunately, it's in the past tense, but the music certainly is there, and I hope that everybody who listens really. Digs deep into his catalog, because there's some great music there. So cheer up, chin up, listen to some Petty, and we will talk to you next week.
I will. Okay, thanks, Jim.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
Take care. And that ends episode 73 of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, a new episode is posted up at WGNplus.com. So click on and have some fun. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. I'm Jim Toronto. Captain Podtastic is the only podcast that goes from the end of the web to your screen.